There are times during surgery when you discover a way to make things easier or more efficient. Sometimes there are through our own quicksand moments. Others are surgical gems gifted to us by our mentors and peers. This is OQC Eureka Moments with Drs. Nicole Fram and Elizabeth Yu, where we learn how to pivot, reflect, and evolve as surgeons.
Welcome, everyone, to the first episode of Ophthalmology Quicksand Chronicles Eureka Moments. We are your hosts. I'm Nicole Fram, and I would love to introduce the amazing Elizabeth Yu.
Hey! We are so excited because this season three, this new season, will be focusing away from all the quicksand, and we're coming out of the dark.
I mean, it's like you have to sing every time.
I can't. I don't know why. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
It's gonna be better.
It's good. You know, I feel like, Liz, there's always a point in surgery when you discover a way to make things easier or more efficient, and you're like, okay, I got it. Next time this happens, I'm gonna use this instrument. I'm gonna think of this technique. And the reason why we wanted to come up with Eureka Moments was we wanted to share these techniques and speed that learning curve. So like, because we're going to show you some of these things, you get to skip that step. You never have to make that mistake that we made and pass down these gems that we've learned from our mentors or that we figured out on our own.
That's exactly right. These clinical surgical pearls or gems combined with these experiences from the sticky quicksand moments have helped to shape our techniques, and they've helped us create these Eureka moments and those figurative plans A, B, C through Z that will help implement and guide us depending on what each situation calls for. But there's no binary yes or no. It shows us that there's an art as well as a science to it all.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's kind of like nothing can teach you experience, but maybe these moments will help you get that experience faster. That's kind of the idea of the whole thing. So this new season will be available through video and audio podcasts. And so you can listen on your favorite platform and you can watch us on YouTube. We're coming back at the end of the podcast. We would love for you to fill out a form, short survey. We really appreciate the feedback, a description of what you found valuable and how we can integrate your suggestions in the future. Cause this is, you know, a moving, living organism of a podcast. And so we would love your feedback.
Yes, it's a moving, living organism that is alive this time because of TruCara Medical. So thank you.
That was an incredible interlude. Wow. Wow.
You like it?
I mean,
it's just for you. It's connecting us from the East Coast to the West Coast.
I mean, first it's love, the singing, and now it's just the metaphors.
Thank you so much to today's sponsor, TruCara Medical.
The ScalPro system is the easy button for osmolarity testing. Testing both eyes in less than 40 seconds. ScalPro is a portable handheld device, which makes it practical in your practice.
Absolutely. And we totally recognize how important that tear osmolarity and how much credibility that it has in recognizing stability in tear film. And as we know, the ASCRS Cornea Clinical Committee with the ocular surface disease or OS disease algorithm, we know the emphasis that we place on our pre-surgical cataract and refractive surgery evaluations and how important it is to utilize these different point of care testing. And the go-to for me is going to be tear film osmolarity. I use that as well as with imaging. I like to look at myography, but so important to look at what that tear film osmolarity does, because that is a snapshot in time for me to look at what that tear film stability looks like. So I love the fact that it is now more portable, easier, faster.
Right. And, you know, the work that you guys did with the algorithm, you know, is incredible, because a lot of algorithms are super confusing. This one really lays it out clearly. And where tear osmolarity helps you is when we're really trying to figure out where this person is with their dry eye. And it's not just about treating their dry eye before the cataract surgery. It's about treating their dry eye after the cataract surgery to maintain, you know, a good tear film without fluctuating vision. And using this kind of point of care can help us not only before the surgery, but later on to keep them going and keep them looking great and seeing great. So thank you so much to Trakara Medical, and we really appreciate the sponsorship.
So Nicole, as you know, and as to all our podcast listeners and our videocast, I don't know if that's the right word, webcast followers, Quicksand Chronicles, we talk informally and we ask each other about our week, eureka moments, shorter sound bites. So I actually have a question for you. Don't you, like, we talk to our patients and we, you know, set these expectations about what surgery is going to be like. Some of them, we're talking to them about advanced technology lenses. You guys are picking options for them, but we know surgery doesn't always go as we planned, right? But I also now know that if something goes awry and the capsule isn't always perfect, surgery doesn't always have to go the wrong way either, right?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is like, you know, I was taught that if anything's wrong with the capsule, that we should leave it alone. You put a lens in the sulcus and you stop. But I think there are times when we can save this surgery. Maybe we're putting in a premium lens, a toric lens. If the anterior capsule is intact or the equatorial zonules are intact, maybe there's stuff we can do with the capsule. So this whole episode is really about, can we use the capsule and how we found those moments where it's appropriate, that eureka moment.
Yes. So Liz, and I'm going to say I'm giving a little bit of credit to Sam Maskett and Nicole Fram firstly, because the idea of reverse optic capture and really putting it out there for decreasing the sulcus space in the use for negative dysphotopsia is somewhat how it started getting in my head with the comfortability of utilizing this technique. Now, I'm gonna share a video of recognizing, okay, I'm starting to become a believer in reverse optic capture. It works really well. And even when I utilize it with square-edged optics, it can be a great technique, which doesn't really cause a lot of chafing, especially with a normal axial length. So how about when there is an open posterior capsule, but I've got a great Rexus? Can I use it with, and it turns out absolutely, with a toric lens implant or even with a diffractive IOL or an EDOF technology. Since I use the femtosecond laser every single time in conjunction with my advanced technology lenses, and if it's only a posterior capsule violation and it's a controlled situation, I wanted to share with you a technique that works really well. And it was, you know, I learned it and it's been demonstrated by different surgeons, but it has been published utilizing it as a primary technique where it's a haptic tuck for reverse optic capture of a single piece acrylic in a scenario where you normally would have aborted a case. So you know that using a limbal relaxing incision or peripheral corneal astigmatic keratotomy is not the best of choices for anyone refractive corneal astigmatism of greater than, I'd say, 0.75 diopters or more. So this is when our preferred choice is going to be a toric lens implant. Well, as you can see here, this is before I had the capability of actually utilizing different technologies to actually identify the steep meridian. I do that with a femtosecond laser now, but you know, you can manually mark, no problem. Well, in this scenario, I'm just demonstrating that I am going through my cataract surgery thinking that all is well. It's a little bit of a more dense lens, so I'm just refilling to endoprotect the eye. I'm thinking all is going very, very smoothly. And then here, I'm just going to go ahead and remove the little bit of cortical material left. You caught. Okay. So what I did not Yeah. So I performed, unbeknownst to me there, don't know where, a primary, huge posterior capsulotomy.
Well, now you don't have to do it yet.
I don't have to do it yet. Right. So, well, I did not disturb the hyaloid face. That's lovely. And at least I caught it before I came out. Right. And so no vitreous loss.
Right.
And I recognized and I said, okay. So I came out and before I injected the lens implant, I said to myself, you know what? I am going to weaken the toric power by not the toric lens implant. I kept the toric power the same because it was in between. So I knew that I would keep the toricity power the same, but I reduced the spherical power by a half diopter. I injected the IOL into the sulcus and I grossly aligned it basically to where the IOL should be, just a little bit shy. Mm-hmm. And then I tucked each of the haptics. First, the first haptic is easy. The second haptic, it gets a little bit more challenging because, and even if the whole thing went into the bag, let's say, right, which it pretty much does, it's going to be okay because it's a controlled scenario. This is when, you know, I'm asking my anesthesia staff to make sure the patient's nice and sleepy, but it's sitting on a bed of viscoelastic. But ideally, the optic itself, a majority of it is still in the sulcus because it is going to be a reverse optic capture. And you can see, unlike when you do a traditional optic capture with a three-piece where it looks more like a cat eye, this is going to have more of that rectangular configuration because the haptic optic junction is wider, as you can see there. Mm-hmm. So it takes on that kind of rectangular appearance at that haptic optic junction. And then once you do your fine, you know, ring to get the toric marker aligned, and I'm just making sure, and here for me, I'm just making sure there's no vitreous. And of course, I put a meiotic into the eye. And then I'm manually removing the viscoelastic with my hydrodissection cannula because the last thing I want to do is create any issues where the actual optic is going to have any tendency to go back. Mm-hmm. And that, my dear, is my, yes.
So there's so many brilliant things that you did. And I just want to emphasize them. Number one, thanks for thanking me and Sam, but it was really, you have the reference of Howard Gimbel that actually talked about that many, many years ago and then published on it. So yes, he deserves all the credit. Now, in terms of, you know, you delivered the lens. So first of all, you caught it, right? Then you filled on your way out with viscoelastic to make sure the hyaloid phase stayed intact, right? And then when you delivered the lens, you put that into the anterior chamber or did you just put it in the sulcus?
This time I put it into the sulcus because the sulcus space was easy, right? Okay. But initially I'm going to say, you know what?
It doesn't matter.
It depends on how stable the eye is, the situation and your comfort level, right? There is nothing wrong with injecting it into the anterior chamber and then gently, then delivering it into the sulcus. Yeah. And then, you know, step by step, you know, if the patient's moving a little bit, make sure that you are in a space where the patient is kind of as still as possible. Right. You feel good. The eye, you know, there's no vitreous. Things are in a stable position before you are getting the haptics into the right position.
Right. And then, so what size Rexus is like, what's your cutoff when you can't do reverse optic capture?
I would say it should be sub 5 millimeters, honestly. And I would say, you know, minimal zonulopathy, obviously,
right,
but anything over 4.5 to 4.9 is going to be ideal.
Right.
Any kind of optic capture when it's sub 4.5 millimeters becomes more challenging to do any form of optic capture, right, because you're like struggling.
Yeah, you're struggling to get it on top. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you talked about adjusting the power, right? So, you know, we don't have enough reverse optic captures in our practice to really truly estimate how much you back off. Do you do a different amount depending on the power of the lens, or how do you think about it?
I do. I just, like I was mentioning, like if this patient, if they were truly exactly one diopter or 150, I would then treat for one diopter. I would go down a half diopter, you know, but this patient was about 175. So it was kind of right in between, you know, so but if you're not certain, leave the toric power alone. Yeah. Leave that piece alone.
Yeah.
So but like the spherical
is what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yep. The spherical power, I would reduce it. I would reduce it unless you're willing to allow that eye to be a little bit myopic. Mm-hmm. You know, the only other scenario is if they're a really low diopter eye, you know, because they're super myopic. But, you know, under 15 to 12, then you might leave it alone.
Right.
Otherwise, over 20.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, I talked to Warren Hill about this and he was like, well, it's about a quarter. And I was like, well, how do we know? You know, like,
yes.
So I don't think anyone knows, but anyone who's going to be pissed off about being like a minus 50 or a minus 75 has a whole other host of issues. So I think, you know, I just think you did that beautifully and just showing how you can tuck it, your bimanual approach at times. You did use preservative-free triamcinolone or washed Kenalog, right? So
that's right. And I dilute it too.
Yeah. One to 10. Yeah.
I do it 1 to 10 because if you try to use the whole aliquot, oh my gosh, it's like forever to, yeah. And then it's just a whole lot of regret, you know, yeah. Of trying to wash it out.
Yeah. And then the last pearl was like always keeping the chamber filled so that the optic didn't prolapse back. Right. And
right,
so that's
right.
And then at the end, I mean, we don't have Reassure hydrogel anymore. Maybe it'll make a comeback, please. Please make a comeback, but making sure all your incisions are super sealed. So Liz, that was beautiful. And I'm going to use that. I mean, I've done reverse optic capture, but I've never done it when I've always like abandoned the case and just put something in the sulcus, three piece in the sulcus and done optic capture. But this kind of controlled approach would be a great save for a presbyopia or an advanced technology IOL. So you want to see mine?
I'm ready, girl.
All right.
I know everyone else is too.
I don't know. Okay. All right. So this is a case of a patient that had surgery with another surgeon and they ran into zonulopathy and the surgeon just didn't feel comfortable moving forward. And I have, you know, so much respect for that, where it's like, it was a really tough case. They got all the material out and they just didn't feel comfortable with the techniques to stabilize the capsule. It was a zonulopathy case. And this is a year later. And the patient, you know, came to me, still had, you know, about a diopter and a quarter of astigmatism. So we decided to tell the patient that we would try and do that with some limbal relaxing incisions. And what you see in this screen is that I'm doing the limbal relaxing incisions, but you see an eye that has a fibrosed capsule with no lens in it. So the anterior and posterior capsules are actually fibrosed together and the posterior capsule is intact. So more and more, I mean, it used to be, I just like put a lens in the sulcus and maybe suture to the iris so it didn't move over time. But more and more, I'm trying to figure out ways to use the capsule. So what I'm doing right now is using a cystotome to initiate a posterior capsulotomy. And what's so interesting is that where the anterior capsulotomy was fibrosed to the posterior capsule, it's serving as like a little template for how to wrap around a perfect kind of 4.5 to 5.0 posterior capsulorhexis. So in this scenario, we have intact zonules, we think. We have the, for at least, you know, 270 degrees, we have these MST Cybele micrograspers that I'm using to wrap around and create this posterior capsulotomy. And at this point, right where you see a lot of the fibrosis, I started to get a little uncomfortable because I felt like I was pulling up right there, pulling on the zonule a little too much. So I had done a 23 gauge trocar that was placed 3.5 millimeters posterior to the limbus, and I'm completing the rest of the posterior capsulotomy using the vitrector. So it's a 23 gauge vitrector. And the ideal size that I learned from Mike Snyder and colleagues is about 4.5 by 5 for a 6 millimeter optic. So 4.5 is really ideal. And sometimes he ovalizes it. And so we're going, you know, back and forth between the anterior and posterior capsule to make this perfect sizing so that then I can put a three-piece in the sulcus and do optic capture. So this is a scenario where we want to use that preservative-free triamcinolone to make sure there's no vitreous prolapse. We are going anteriorly and posteriorly back and forth, starting posteriorly, then anteriorly, and we make this perfect rexus size. Then this is an LI61AO three-piece lens that you're putting in, but you can put in any acrylic lens, any three-piece lens, that is. And then we're rotating this into the sulcus. And then what we're going to do, you know, I used to think that optic capture was like, you just put down and it's magically captured, right? But it's really kind of a push, like a little sneaking in under each leaflet of the under the anterior and posterior capsule that's fused. So right here, we're going to use a Sinsky and we're going to tuck that down and then sneak it in on one side. And then we're going to tuck that down and sneak it in on the other. Now, if I got into a scenario right now, as I'm doing the other side where the zonule wasn't stable, I would just prolapse the whole thing into the sulcus and suture the haptics to the iris. So I wouldn't just keep pushing. Like, you have to have good anterior, posterior, and equatorial zonules for this to work because there is some manipulation. And as Liz said, this is now more like a cat eye appearance. It's not a square appearance that you get with a single piece acrylic lens. But after seeing, you know, Liz's video, I'm like, why didn't I do a toric? I could have done that. But, you know, I didn't have all that confidence at that time. So again, you know, filling on the way out so that we don't have vitreous prolapse, using your preservative-free triamcinolone or washed Kent, which is therapeutic and diagnostic all at the same time. And then I get most of the viscoelastic out using bimanual approach. And then, as Liz said, manually at the end, you want to get it out with just your 27 gauge cannula and then checking that everything's normotensive. And OCDing out with fluorescein is something that I do to make sure everything's cytal negative. So that's just a quick little video on how to use the capsule even secondarily when you have a case where someone just completely abandoned ship.
You know, what I love, the most amazing thing is the human body. You know how you do the vitrectomy, right? And you know, you vitrectomize the whole thing, you know, just to kind of widen it just a little bit to make it the perfect size. And with the manipulation, with the optic capture, I want everyone to recognize that over time, the capsule actually gains strength.
Right.
Because it doesn't behave like if we try to do that during primary cataract surgery, that whole thing would have fallen apart.
Right.
But over time, because it becomes kind of fibrotic, it actually, you can manipulate it like she did, but it was because you took those small bites all the way through and it was kind of spread tension equally. It wasn't like a split anywhere, right. Kind of like a can opener style, that same idea. But that's why you were able to have that beautiful opening, and you could tug and you can also push a little bit in order to do the optic capture without any compromise to the actual capsulotomy, that secondary capsulotomy.
Yeah. And I didn't know that I could do that. Like, I went into it saying, well, if the other surgeon had problems with zonulopathy, I'll probably have problems with zonulopathy. So when I went in there, I said, listen, I'm going to try this, but I was ready to go to plan B or even do intraoral haptic fixation if you don't feel comfortable with iris fixation. So yeah, I mean, that was surprising to me to see, hey, I can use that capsule. So,
right.
You know, I think in these two cases that we've shown is that there are scenarios when you think, you know, it's over, you can't use it. Like, go to plan Z. You can actually use the capsule and save the case.
This is beautiful. I'm telling you, it kind of reaffirms and reiterates what David Chang showed us, you know, on our last episode with quicksand, which is doing optic capture can actually have greater strength and stability than even putting the three piece within the bag itself. So it's that same idea. And you can do that, you know, even afterwards in a case where you didn't feel, you may not have felt at the time, it's the right time to actually put a lens in the bag. Right. So this is great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being with us for our first episode of OQC Eureka Moments. I love that. We hope that sharing these techniques will help to speed the learning curve and pass down the gems that have been gifted us to us by mentors and through peers, Dr. Gimbel and others. But please remember, I mean, this has been an in evolution. We started with Quicksand Chronicles and through feedback, et cetera. Here we are today with Eureka Moments. So please email us with other ideas and feedback at quicksandchronicles@ascrs.org with any questions, feedback, and other comments. And don't forget to fill out the brief survey below.
Okay, great. And remember, every time you think you have the eyeball figured out, it's going to humble you.
And of course, we hope that these collective experiences will help develop grace under pressure. Thank you and see you next time.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of OQC Eureka Moments with Drs. Nicole Fram and Elizabeth Yu. Hindsight really is 2020.